Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me as usual at the studios of CBS Interactive, Scott Rohde of PR agency House Party.
Hey, Tim.
And our guest today, Pitch Doctor Extraordinaire Darren Woolley.
Hi, Tim.
Coming up today, Old Spice, the best use of social media yet. Another band ad, this time for the Brisbane Broncos. Media Watch takes on the Conscience Organisation. The ABC sets the date for News 24. Promises of a PR man. Should every agency and media owner do a viral? And in television, real-life Sopranos and The Chaser returns. So today, first we talk to Darren Woolley. I know it's been a few weeks now, but I can't resist bringing up the whole bottom feeders incident. Are you a bottom feeder?
Look, I don't think so, and I think there's probably people behind us.
Probably worth explaining for those who don't know what we're talking about.
James Warburton's comments at the MFA breakfast launch of their awards. Look, I think James was basically trying to garner favour with the media agencies there, because obviously they do a lot of business with the media agencies. We're probably an easy target, Pitch Consultants. Being lumped in with procurement, I think, was particularly galling.
That's the issue, isn't it? Because presumably you wouldn't see yourself as philosophically from the same place at all.
Well, I think we certainly are part of the procurement function and probably take a higher stand, like good procurement people would, which is it's about sustainable relationships. But too much procurement at the moment is all about how cheap can we get it. And unfortunately, what that's doing is driving down revenue and ultimately impacting on the quality of the services that clients are getting.
So it's a false economy. When you're running a pitch, what are the sort of criteria you generally would be looking at?
Well, of course, you have to match culture and capability. But let's focus on the remuneration part. And what we've seen recently is so many clients really just looking at the total number that they're paying the agency, rather than linking that to what the agency is going to be providing to them. We've had pitches recently where we've got the scope of work, calculated what we thought the resources would be and the cost of those resources, and then there's been constant pressure on the agencies to come in way below. And we're seeing 20 or 30% discount on our benchmarks.
Now, how far can you go with the client in persuading them that that's, assuming it isn't, necessarily a good idea, you know, because presumably the long-term thing is it's not sustainable for the agency, they won't do their best work, you know, all of those things. In the end, though, the client, I suppose, is your master, so you can give them the advice, but if they don't take it, you're the tool of driving down that price.
Look, and Tim, good marketers actually are very receptive to the message that, you know, they need to make sure they get what they pay for, and if they pay too little, they'll get less. The trouble is, as you know, everyone knows, there is a rise in procurement, and the procurement people are saying cheaper is better. But good marketers know that cheaper is not better. Cheaper just means cheaper.
And does it run across all types of agencies as much, say, for a creative pitch as for a media agency pitch?
Media is under more pressure than creative because there's less variables. You know, anyone that's involved in negotiations know that the more variables you negotiate on, the more points, then usually the more successful you can be in maintaining a position. But with media, it's largely spend, resources, and then how much you're paying for that. Whereas creative, you've got production rate cards, you've got retainers, you've got head hour fees. The big beneficiary of this whole process is probably digital, because everyone, marketers and procurement, have a real problem getting their heads around the variables in the digital area.
Well, I was going to ask about digital and also about PR as well. So, you know, agency like Scott, I mean, you've probably never even been through a pitch consultant-led PR pitch, have you?
Just one, when I worked for another agency, but that was 3 years ago, I think that was. But only once.
And what was that experience like?
It was kind of interesting. It was nice to see how someone else works, kind of from an external point of view, because it helped kind of the company revitalise their thinking a lot of the time. But on the flip side of that, I found that they, you know, they didn't really know enough about the agency that us at the time, you know, because they hadn't worked with us before, to actually know the best way to kind of put us forward.
Oh, so they were helping you. So rather than running the pitch on behalf of the client, they were helping you.
Yeah.
Intriguing model. That's relatively rare, isn't it?
Absolutely. And because I think it's rare because already the agency, PR, digital, creative, are already spending a lot of money investing in the pitch process to then add a consultant cost in on top of that. You know, it's difficult to justify.
Did you win the pitch?
I'm not saying.
And why do you think that more PR pieces of PR business aren't being run by pitch consultants?
I think because it's more based on relationship and actually the PR consultants being able to have the chemistry to really get involved. PR operates not at the marketing level alone. It also operates at corporate affairs and corporate strategy level. You know, there's a lot more stakeholder relationship. And so the decisions are made, from my experience, on the relationship between the corporate team and the PR agency more than just who's got the best idea.
Yeah. Now, a fairly extraordinary story from out of the UK, which actually you pointed us towards, is this one involving a pitch with UK-based travel agent Thomas Cook, who appear to be asking agencies to pay $1 million success fee. So the business is worth, in theory, something like $10 million.
And £30 million.
£30 million.
So it's a £30 million media pitch. And Thomas Cook Procurement have said that any agency that is involved in the pitch will agree to pay a £1 million success fee.
Wow.
Now, jeez. That, when you do any of the numbers, is about a third to two-thirds of the first year of revenue for any media agency. I mean, it's just ridiculous. This is procurement gone crazy. They're actually turning the selection process into a profit centre for their company.
And can you see that potentially happening in Australia, for instance? Have there been similar sort of smaller examples?
Not in Australia, but this all started with Reckitt Benckiser in India earlier this year. They also ran a pitch where agencies were told that if to participate, they would have to agree to a success fee. And it really is driven by an attitude where agencies, and when I use the term agencies, I mean all marketing services providers, are seen as basically just a service provider to be, what was the term that the guy from Reckitt used, chiseled to the lowest possible cost. Wow. So it shows a fundamental attitude or relationship that these marketers have.
Shouldn't everybody just agree to just not go for those pitches?
You'd like to think so. And,
but they don't because they want the business. And
£30 million is £30 million. I mean, it's false economy because ultimately, to be sustainable, the agency, successful agency, is going to have to recoup that £1 million. And they'll do that through either under-resourcing, through doing backdoor deals with the media that are not necessarily in the best interest of the client. To survive, they will have to pay the fee but find, let's say, less than, professional practices.
Is it legitimate in some circumstances to charge a success fee? I know that some of the pitch consultants in this
never.
Market... Right, okay.
Never. Absolutely. Well, never. No way.
Let me put the alternative view to you. I understand that one or two pitch consultants in this market do ask for a success fee. They're upfront. They talk to all of the agencies beforehand. And they're not just paid by the client, but they are also paid by the successful agency, so all of the agencies entering it know up front. Why isn't that okay?
The fact of the matter is that the cost of business for an agency is to actually pitch for the business. To then have an additional cost means that then puts pressure on the agencies financially to include more in their overhead at a time when procurement and marketing are looking for lower overheads. So what you're actually doing is adding in an additional cost that's not necessary. Mm. I mean, ultimately, the person that will get the ultimate cost is the marketer choosing the right agency. So to then add an additional cost to that, and especially doing it in the way that it's done, which is the successful agency paying for it, you know, is their reward should be getting the business, not having to pay their fee for getting the business.
I just finished a pitch yesterday. We pitched to the client yesterday.
No wonder you're under the weather. I bet you've not been sleeping at all.
And I probably knocked in about, you know, 20, 25 hours, you know, doing the research, you know, and just doing my section of the pitch type thing. And, you know, you do burn up a lot of hours getting involved. Everybody does. Everybody entirely at the company get involved. And it does take its toll because, you know, if you're pitching twice a month. That's a lot of hours getting taken out of the actual business time that you should be doing actually the job for your other clients.
How does one become qualified to do what you do? What was your career route, Darren?
I'm a creative person, copywriter and a creative director, and heavily involved in new business on the, you know, as part of being on the agency team. The reason I got into pitch consulting was really to look at better ways, because there are so many pitches you're involved in where it's not a level playing field, where the objectives of the client and the agency are not aligned. And so really, you know, qualification, I'm qualified because I've worked on lots of pitches, but other than that, it's really bringing an attitude or a philosophy to the process and whether marketers find that attractive or not.
Next up, Old Spice sets Twitter on fire. Now, it's not often you come across an ad campaign that everyone loves.
Everybody loves this.
Wyden and Kennedy created an ad for Old Spice that was the very successful, won lots at Cannes this year, won the film Grand Prix. But then this week, it came back and took Twitter by storm.
I think it took Twitter and YouTube and Facebook.
Well, maybe just, do you want to describe what it was they did?
Yeah, what they did was they've looked at their different channels. They've got the actual Old Spice advert on, which is obviously Facebook, YouTube and Twitter, and have taken people comments from Facebook, people comments from Twitter and people's comments from their YouTube channel and replied to about 160 of them. Now, they were quite cunning.
Some good ones. There was one of the great ones was someone, he asked somebody to propose. So we'll just hear that one.
On Twitter, J.S. Beals tweets, "Can you ask my girlfriend to marry me? Her name is Angela A. Hutt-Chamberlain. J.S. Beals, thank you for your tweet, and I'd be honored to honorably honor your honorable request. Miss Angela A. Hutt-Chamberlain, it seems like yesterday that you met J.S. Beals, but your love has blossomed from a seed into a fully grown love plant. And now it's time to fertilize that plant. Angela A. Hutt-Chamberlain, will you make J.S. Beals the happiest man in the world and marry him in real life? We'll be eagerly awaiting your reply." Eagerly.
So that was just one example.
That was a bit curious because the person involved has about 65 followers and runs a kind of, because I had a little bit of investigation into that. The person involved has got like 65 followers and follows like 12 people on Twitter or something. So very unusual that that person was chosen. Obviously, I don't know if they're connected to the...
Well, I'd argue it was on the interestingness of the content.
It could have been, but you would have to... How many people have replied to Old Spice? So to find that little nugget is quite rare.
Yeah, Darren, what do you make of it?
Look, I think it's a very clever campaign, and to actually take it to that next step is just absolutely brilliant. I mean, too often you see people start with a great idea and then it just sort of fades away to nothing. So, but I think content, you know, the content is just brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, the original advert ran, what, 6 months ago, a year ago, or something like that?
Yeah, this year.
Yeah, it's taken a lot of steam to build up. You know, it was shared around a lot. But, you know, the adverts falling on from the original have also been as good as the original, which I think's made that difference as well, that, you know, they've not just went with the same idea and kind of killed it. They've actually kind of just kept it on the same level, and then they've brought in these new ones, which are genius.
But don't you think it's the Cannes Award and the fact that it was recognised there? You know, a lot of people criticise creative awards, but when you've got awards with that sort of level, especially media level of Cannes, that award won. And so suddenly there was this whole spike off the back of that, and then the second ad following soon.
Yes, it gives it sort of credibility, doesn't it? To me, I suppose what makes this so good as well isn't that, hey, this is a social media thing. It's the fact that the PR element, the fact that there were so many tailored videos aimed at media outlets who are then going to bring it to their audiences, is just a really good example where a simple ad meets social media, meets PR.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it quite, you know, such a powerful campaign.
Yeah, I mean, you look at some of the targets they hit Ellen DeGeneres, obviously they hit Ashton Kutcher.
Huffington Post.
Yeah, but then you look at, like, they got one of my friends, Cliff Blazinski, who creates the Gears of War 2 video game. He got hit with it as well, because he'd asked him, you know, do you always drive around with your, do you do everything with your shirt off? And then he obviously hit him back saying, I play your video games with my shirt off type thing. And, you know, it's that connecting, and knowing the right people to connect to and actually speaking the right message to them. That was a really important
bit. The sheer quantity of videos, you know, something more than 100 little 30-second videos have popped up already in the last few days. Wearing your previous copywriter hat, how big a team do you think is behind this?
Looking at the production, I think it's actually quite small. There's probably only a couple of people going through, researchers, looking at all the requests, then a couple of teams just bouncing around ideas, writing it very quickly, because they're not writing to time and they're not having to worry about the pack shot.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then the way they're shooting it is so cost effective. One set, you could probably whip out, you know, 100 of those a day. Easily.
Did you know that the girl said yes to the marriage proposal?
Do you know, I had read that somewhere, yes. That's the thing, that's isn't right. it? Yeah. And you know, the exciting thing is, as we record this, we're into the first 24 or 36 hours of this as well, and it's already become... incidentally, we wrote about it early on Mumbrella on Wednesday morning, and it was our second biggest ever day for traffic.
Wow.
Since Mumbrella started, with three quarters of our traffic yesterday coming just to that one story. Wow. So it's certainly one that set Twitter ablaze. Now, next up, we talk another banned ad. So an ad for NRMA Insurance featuring members of AFL team the Brisbane Broncos has been banned because one of the players is seen pinching chocolate. So what happens in the ad is all of the Broncos are helping out good old NRMA because, hey, they've got such good offers or something. And, of course, they're hilariously out of place. But one of the players shakes the chocolate machine, apparently, because his chocolate bar that he has just paid for is stuck. But, of course, lots more come out and he takes them. And this has been banned. Darren, good decision by the standards board?
Look, I think it's indicative of the nanny state we live in, where we expect everyone else to actually do the role of raising our children and giving them good values. So, you know, I think it's overkill. And if I read rightly, it was actually the complaint was brought about by the vending machine proprietors.
That's right. It was a vending machine owner who actually put the complaint in. That's correct. I'd forgotten that. Scott?
Dumbest decision I've seen in a long while. What Darren says about the nanny state is pretty much spot on. You get these... Everybody just wants to be hand-held these days or hand-fed. Do you know what? Go out there and start thinking for yourself a little bit more. That's what I say. You know, I'm sick of this. Government needs to, you know, let people live their lives and stop telling them what to do.
Next, when Media Watch took on the Conscience Organisation. So this week, Media Watch ran a rather odd investigation on a press release from Boost Mobile. Let's hear a clip.
Texting has sparked at least four new physical and mental disorders, and growing numbers of Australian teenagers are being affected.
A mobile monster.
Australian teenagers are becoming text addicts, suffering a range of serious mental and physical disorders, from depression to repetitive thumb syndrome.
They're calling it textosis, or post-traumatic text disorder. It's a new medical condition, and it affects children almost exclusively.
They're calling it textosis? Who are they? Doesn't sound like the sort of name the College of Psychiatry would come up with, does it? Well, here's who.
Media release.
Textophrenia, textiety, post-traumatic text disorder, and binge texting. These are the four latest texting-related disorders to be identified by Boost Mobile.
Now, what was strange about this whole thing was, Scott, a real staple of the PR world is the survey or the piece of scientific research. To me, it feels like this benevolent might be the wrong word, but benevolent conspiracy between journalists and PRs that they get some interesting copy based on a slightly hokey survey. The journos kind of know it's hokey, but they also know it's an entertaining story. That's how PR works, isn't it?
It's not how PR works. It's how a tiny segment of PR works.
But every day it goes on.
It does happen a lot in agencies. I've been involved in a few different things, that kind of stuff. But I don't agree with linking medical issues to, you know, to a campaign. I think the moment you start doing that and you start blending the truth into something else, it's
the
a bit dangerous.
This one felt like fun to me. It was textaholics, you know. Did anybody... It was effectively as I see it, the Conscious Organisation created this Facebook group, you know, for Textaholics Anonymous, which was to plug Boost Mobile. Darren, my impression was people signing up for that group didn't really think they had a medical problem. They thought it was fun, didn't they? Didn't the consumers, yeah, look, weren't they in on the joke?
It was clearly satirical. I mean, you know, even though it had a medical reference, this was all about fun. It was targeted at a youth target segment. So I think, you know, the fact that the media picked it up is probably more a reflection of the media willing to run a story like that. And maybe they were doing it tongue-in-cheek as well. I think the Media Watch missed the whole tone of the campaign.
What if you'd been looking at the PR side of things, is, yep, there anything you would have done differently, Scott?
I probably would have, in the press release, the second article alludes to the fact that the research from the professionals at the universities links in with these, you know, these conditions, and that's where I think that is the one thing that they went wrong with in that. Because the moment you do that, you are basically saying these professors have agreed that these are now terms being used. And that was the bit for me. I was like, well, I'm not quite sure about that because you're taking it away in the wrong turn. But on the saying that, I think the journalists shouldn't have ran the story without checking more facts. I mean, that's their job. They should always check their facts.
Yeah, the paper, the research paper they referred to had no reference to any of those medical conditions or actually saying that texting causes any sort of psychological or physical problems.
Although the funny thing was, I don't think the press release would have been any weaker without that paragraph.
I agree.
You know, if there was a paragraph that probably went too far, it was that paragraph. Mm. But of course, it wasn't the Conscious of the Organisation that wrote the press release.
It wasn't, yep.
Which is what made me feel that maybe Media Watch had gone after the wrong target, potentially.
I think that they did go after the wrong target. I think TCO's campaign on Facebook was fine. I think it was the problem was that the press release sent journalists down the wrong path.
Well, speaking of the ABC, next up we talk ABC News 24. So the ABC has finally set a date to launch the news channel ABC News 24 next week, next Thursday the 22nd, which is a shame really, because if they'd only done it 2 days later, they could have launched it on the 24th of the 7th, which would have been 24/7.
Smart man.
Somebody, it wasn't me who pointed out. Right. Somebody, somebody on Twitter pointed that one out. Scott or Darren, do you reckon there is room for another 24-hour news channel?
Do you know what I hate more than anything lately? 24-hour news channels are people just standing around outside houses and people going, and over to you, and then they're all, nothing's happening, and constantly bounce. It's like they're trying to create news when it's not there.
Everyone's waiting for an election, aren't they?
Yeah, and I don't watch it. I just turn it off because you just think, I don't want people standing around. I could just go stand around and look at people outside.
Do you look at Sky News, for instance, Darren?
Yeah, look, I think having it there, whether you sit there watching news 24/7, but certainly when you travel, I think it's important for any country to have its national broadcaster giving national news 24/7. The BBC do a brilliant job with that, and they do that globally, and I think it'd be good to see the ABC running a 24/7 news right through the region, not just in Australia.
Yes, and I suppose that's the one of the opportunities is the stuff for the Australia network is, if they've got a 24-hour news channel already going out of Australia, then potentially put some of the things there. I've had a sneak preview of the studio, by the way. Because they're already running 24 hours a day, and that includes a show called The Drum, which is based on their comment site. So that's going out at, it must be 6 o'clock, 6 till 6:45 every night. So they're already running, you know, all the way through pilots of it. So I sat in on one of the pilots.
And
it looks good?
Well, it looks good. It's the problem I get when you start describing, you know, TV studios is, you know, it's very clean and shiny and quite big, and there were cameras and auto cues and, you know, TVs, and the set looked quite fresh. But, you know, all of those things you could say about television. The only difference I could notice between them and Sky News is at ABC News 24, you get your makeup done.
To be honest, I'd rather watch ABC News over Sky. I mean, that's just a personal preference, because then I know it's probably at least less biased than Sky does.
I'm going to defend Sky there, though. I don't think Sky is particularly biased at all. I know that there's a Murdoch investment, and there's always deception.
But that's what I'll see. I'll see that if there's a Murdoch investment, there's a potential for...
Yeah, I would argue Sky News has got a pretty good reputation in the UK and over here.
I think they've got a fantastic
reputation,
but I'd still rather do...
Yeah, but compare that to, you know, CNN, Fox News, and BBC, for instance. Yeah, I mean, they're really brands in their own right, and they will you know, etch out a position in the marketplace. People, you know, I know people in the States that watch nothing but Fox.
That's terrifying.
But that's fits with their belief
it's
system.
Different
styles. So, yeah.
Because I have quite a low attention span. For instance, when I was in the UK, Sky News versus BBC News 24, you know, when big momentous events happened, I might turn to the BBC, but for moving wallpaper in the background, I found Sky News far more entertaining.
And CNN compared to BBC, and I think ABC News 24/7 is a great initiative.
Next up, we talk free PR. Now, PR man Jody Hughes, who you might remember was caught out a while back hiring actors to appear on A Current Affair when he was promoting a previous story for a previous client, he's returned to the public relations industry with a new model: media coverage or don't pay him.
Didn't somebody do this first, 6 months ago?
It certainly comes around. Now, firstly, let's just get this one out of the way. I know that publicity isn't everything that public relations does.
I was so ready to go with that one.
Yes, it's media relations, not public relations.
Exactly. Good model, Scott. So effectively, you know, I was a small business.
Small business, yeah. Go to somebody, get them to write a release, get them to send it out, and then rethink that that's everything that PR companies do. And then when your company grows bigger, even through not doing that, that's what you think PR companies are going to do, when actually that's not just what they do.
But I've met plenty of people who've, you know, got somebody in for 3 months, 6 months, paid them retainer, and got almost nothing out of it.
I know, it does happen. But on the flip side, it's not what a PR company does. It's not, you know, we're not just about getting a release out. And I just think that this kind of idea, and this just pushes this negative image of what PR does. And, you know, PR does take a battering a lot of the time, you know. So I'll stick up and defend it.
Darren?
But the highest profile part of public relations is media relations.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so that's, you know, it's the same as television being the highest profile part of advertising. So you'll always be known by what people see you doing. And I think if there's an advertiser that just wants to get media exposure, then this is quite a good model for them to get paid on. The trouble is, they're going to also have to say to the client, you know what you've got to say is absolutely not newsworthy, and so I'm not going to waste any time on your business because I won't get you any exposure. And I can imagine that would be a very difficult conversation to have.
It would also be interesting to see MD who does a research on this guy and says, oh, do I really want to trust somebody that's been yanked up like the way he has?
Next up, agency virals. Now, for this one, I would love to be able to play you a clip, but unfortunately, it's more visual than audio, so I won't be able to. Scott, Hothouse is your parent agency to House Party PR. So you're moving house, or you've just moved offices. So there's a nice little video of Simon Van Wyk being shot out of a cannon to the new thing.
What did you think of it, Tim?
I thought it was okay. I thought that I wasn't sure how it was going to go when I posted it. I was very, very neutral how I posted it because I wasn't sure that it would get ripped apart or not. No, it actually didn't, did it?
No, it didn't.
And there've been a few, you know, there've been a few agency virals recently. There was Leo Burnett did the.
I'm going to say it's not a viral. It's just a funny video.
Okay, let's use the word viral in the most generic, not an assumption that it is going to go viral, but a funny little skit or whatever we call it. But there have been a few. There's been the Leo Burnett with Todd Sampson lip syncing to I'm So Excited, which they quickly yanked down when people spotted it. there've also been a couple of sort of, you know, media companies have been doing some recently as well. Is there a value to this, Darren? You know, is it just a point of difference? Or?
Look, I think the hardest thing for any company to do is self-promotion because they usually have very little self-awareness. So any agency, any company, PR, digital, that is able to go out there and actually put some message out is at least a step forward, because we spend most of our time trying to convince clients to do that, and that we're the best people to advise them, or the agency is, and then do very little themselves. So, look, any effort's a good effort. In this case, I thought it was a little corny, but still, you know, good effort.
And finally, we'll be talking television. So, in TV this week, MasterChef carries on going. underbellies. I'm not sure we can describe him as underbellies, Mick Gatto, really, can we? He was somebody who came to fame thanks to Underbelly. Anyway, he set to star in a real-life version of The Sopranos, and The Chase were returning to the ABC with their pre-election series, Yes We Can, Bro. So let's unpick a few of those. Firstly, so a bit of background, Mick Gatto, Melbourne identity, I believe, is one of those legal words that covers everything with everyone knowing what it means. He's had a film crew following him for the last few weeks. The film crew thinks that they'll be able to get an interesting real-life version of The Sopranos out of it. Would you be tuning in, Scott?
No. That's probably the best thing I can say. No, I probably wouldn't. I'm not a big fan of real-life dramas on personalities. I don't think that we should be, glamorising certain personalities, and that's a stance I've always taken. And I don't think that one of my problems with Underbelly is that it kind of glamorises the criminal underworld, which I'm not a big fan of.
Darren, do you think this will find an audience?
Well, I've actually had a phone call from Mick Gatto one day. It was a case of mistaken identity. He was looking for P3 Constructions and called P3, us, and said, asked for someone who I didn't recognise the name, but I recognised Mick Gatto. And he said, look, it's about the 10 grand you owe someone. And I said, look, I think you've got the wrong number. And he goes, this is P3 Constructions, isn't it? No, P3 Marketing Media, nothing to do with building. And he goes, oh, okay, I've got the wrong number. I'll have a good day, and hung up. Well, I have to tell you, it was the most frightening 30 seconds of my life. So I probably won't watch it, but certainly I think he's compelling.
No.
Compelling on the end of your phone.
Another one that I suspect will draw an audience is The Chaser, returning for, I think it's 4 specials, Yes We Can, Bro, which we were talking about, everyone waiting for the election to be called, not least the ABC. We've got the Gruen Nation waiting to leap onto the airwaves. We've got Yes We Can, Bro. What is it about The Chaser that draws people's attention?
Oh, look, I think it appeals to the university anarchist inside all of us. It's that ability to poke fun at institutions, and the fact every time they step beyond the boundaries, we love it even more. Mm.
Well, that's all we have time for today. So thank you very much to my co-host, Scott Rohde.
Thanks, Tim.
And to our guest, Darren Woolley.
Thank you.
Thank you also to CBS for use of their studios. Production was by Georgina Pearson. That was the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle-pip.